From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. In the Senate this afternoon, President Trump's legal team is wrapping up its defense of the president against two articles of impeachment. It is still unclear whether Democrats have convinced enough Republicans to vote with them to call witnesses. Joining us now is NPR's Tim Mak, who covers national security and politics for NPR. Tim, senators still seem to be digesting and taking stock of these new revelations from former national security advisor John Bolton, who apparently claims in a forthcoming book that President Trump told him he wanted Ukraine military aid to be conditioned on Ukraine investigating Joe Biden. Now there's talk today of senators maybe getting Bolton's manuscript to look at. Why is that, and what's the latest?
So this is all based around this argument that the Trump defense team has been making. One of their major arguments throughout this trial has been there's been no one to testify. There's been no firsthand testimony that links directly and personally the president of the United States to this this effort to leverage U.S. foreign policy for personal political gain. They say that just has – it's been secondhand information or third-hand information. Now, Democrats would disagree with this. But what John Bolton provides with his book and possibly with his testimony is someone who would be able to refute that particular line of argument, that John Bolton has personal information, according to these reports, about this alleged scheme. Now, the talk about senators getting Bolton's manuscript, this is kind of a compromise. Some Senate Republicans have suggested the idea of bringing in the manuscript into the Senate in a secure area and allowing senators to read it.
Well, and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer does not like that idea at all. Here he is responding to that.
What an absurd proposal. It's a book. There's no need for it to be read in the skiff unless you want to hide something.
So what about the idea of Bolton testifying, which is what we were talking about yesterday, and whether even Chief Justice John Roberts, who's presiding over the trial, might play a role in that?
Well, the Democratic argument has been that there's no need to read the book if you could subpoena John Bolton to testify under oath. Chuck Schumer said in that same press conference where you played that clip from that President Trump and John Bolton have said diametrically opposed things, and only one of the two, that's John Bolton, is willing to testify under oath. So that's the argument there, that the book is one thing, subpoenaed witness and testimony is another thing. As for whether or not Chief Justice John Roberts might play a role in that, you know, if you observe the Chief Justice over the course of this trial so far, you haven't seen him get very interested in being particularly activist or aggressive in his rulings. Now, if he were to say, for example, break a tie, that would be a very activist role and a very activist action.
And he's very worried about the credibility of the Supreme Court and not looking like he's picking one side or the other. I want to play you some tape from Iowa Senator Republican Joni Ernst, who said this yesterday after the Trump team was spending a lot of time talking about Joe and Hunter Biden. Ernst said this yesterday about that.
Iowa caucuses, folks. Iowa caucuses are this next Monday evening, and I'm really interested to see how this discussion today informs and influences the Iowa caucus voters, those Democratic caucus goers. Will they be supporting Vice President Biden at this point?
So Joe Biden said Ernst spilled the beans on what the Republican strategy really is with this trial, which is just to tar his presidential candidacy. How is that resonating in the Senate today?
Well, Democrats are really playing up this particular clip. They're saying that it's evidence that this entire trial from a Republican perspective has just been hijacked in order to play a role of smearing former Vice President Joe Biden, that by having this trial and by making these arguments that smear Mr. Biden, they've in essence done what the president had hoped to do from the beginning, which is to cast doubt on whether Joe Biden and his family have been ethical.
That is NPR's Tim Mak, who covers national security and politics for NPR, as the Trump team wraps up its defense today in the Senate trial, and then it is on to written questions. Tim, we'll be talking to you. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
The National Transportation Safety Board is poring over the scene of the crash that killed NBA legend Kobe Bryant and eight others in Calabasas, California on Sunday. In his final transmission, the pilot of the helicopter reported to air traffic control that he was climbing above a cloud layer to gain greater visibility. There was no black box in the helicopter. Meanwhile, tributes continue to pour in for the victims, including Bryant's 13-year-old daughter. Kelly Carter, longtime journalist and writer for The Undefeated, interviewed Kobe over the years. Her last interview was a candid and introspective look at his career and plans for the future. Kelly, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
Well, in your last interview with Kobe, you write that he didn't necessarily want to talk basketball, but rather his plans in Hollywood and his role as a father. And as I read it, I thought, this is a real look at a progression of a man. We've all watched it from him being a teenager to a basketball phenom. And then this latest stage in life, what struck you most about this evolution?
Yeah, you know, first off, Kobe was ridiculously intelligent, just intelligent beyond measure. And I feel silly in some ways saying that, but I also think that it's necessary to say that too, because I think a lot of times we very much discount the intellect of athletes. We look at them as kind of almost inhumane machines. And Kobe was definitely in this kind of growing fraternity of male athletes who were really out on a mission to prove to themselves, and I imagine everyone else, that there was more to them than just the athleticism that we praised them for. And so, you know, he's someone who studied about what he wanted to be his next chapter, which was Hollywood. He was able to reach out to people who have been doing this and doing this well at high levels of excellency.
You wrote that his mentor was Oprah.
Oprah Winfrey, but also Shonda Rhimes. You know, one thing that Kobe was telling me was, to his amusement and kind of childlike surprise, is that fandom that he was getting back from an industry like Hollywood that he wanted to gain entry into.
Did he talk to you about what he wanted to do?
Yeah. He said that what he wanted to do was create content that always centered around sports. And he really looked at, and it's kind of funny when you think about it, but he really looked at Dear Basketball, the animated short that he won his Oscar for, as an experiment. An experiment that won the biggest prize you can possibly win in Hollywood. It was the most Kobe Bryant thing that Kobe Bryant could have done, but because that was a love letter and a breakup to the only thing that he'd known and loved. And, you know, interesting story about Kobe Bryant that not a lot of people are wholly aware, but certainly it's something that I talked to him about, is that he was supposed to play Jesus Shuttlesworth.
I read that in your
piece.
Yes.
Not Ray Allen. Spike Lee had picked Kobe to do this. At the time, Kobe was this, you know, newly minted hotshot rookie, and he was all set to do it, but then he just, you know, wanted to spend the summer working on free throws and, you know, the game of basketball. So he pulled out of that movie
at the last minute.
And I asked him if he regretted that and if that was something that he wanted to do, because we see that's really the entryway for a lot of people who are in the sports world who want to get into Hollywood.
Yep.
You know, you look at Kyrie Irving.
Kobe
said no. He's like, I am not a front of camera person. You know, he wanted to wield his power behind the scenes and really just create opportunities. He wanted to diversify. You know, he wanted to see more women and more people of color gain entry into this profession. And that's really what he was trying to do.
Yeah. And thinking about his evolution, one other thing that really struck me, not only in your writing, but in your dear friend Jemele Hill's writing about the evolution of Kobe, she wrote about an argument that both of them had around the killing of Trayvon Martin, who was shot to death in Florida. But then how Kobe's thinking evolved in that, and how he wanted to be very introspective and actually talk through that evolution. A lot of people are also grappling with what to include in Kobe's story. And his legacy, the rape allegation is one. Have you thought about this?
Yeah, you know, I have, and I'll be honest with you. I, like a lot of other people, I'm not quite sure what to say about that. You know, Kobe, in the aftermath of that allegation in particular, apologized. And in his apology, what he said was, at the time, I thought it was consensual. It is evidence to me now that she didn't. And for that, I apologize. And I wonder if we should give someone the space to have growth and evolution. And I think about who I was at 17 and where my ideologies were when I was 17, when I was 21, versus where my ideology is now. And I know that Kobe was a little bit older. He wasn't a teenager when the allegations happened. But I think that what gives us growth and evolution is experience, right? Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes we don't allow people with great visibility that same extension. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if this is a case where we should do that, but maybe it is. Mm-hmm. It's just hard. And I choose to believe that because he was a father of four girls, that also probably changed his perspective on the agency that women have over their bodies. And unfortunately, we will never know if he arrived at that particular place. We're only left with assumptions, I think.
Yeah. Kelly Carter is writer for The Undefeated. Thank you so much for joining us, Kelly.
Thanks for having me.
It was a big night for Billie Eilish at the Grammys on Sunday. Eilish won 5 Grammys, including Song of the Year for Bad Guy.
I'm the bad guy. Duh.
That hit was co-written and produced by her brother, Finneas O'Connell, who also won the Grammy for Producer of the Year on Sunday. He may not be as well known as Eilish, but besides producing, he's also been an actor on Glee. And last year, he released a solo album called Blood Harmony. I spoke with Finneas O'Connell in the fall. So we should mention that in addition to all of those things, you're also Billie Eilish's big brother. How did it feel to step out on your own on this tour?
It's been a really fun process. It's been nerve-wracking. I think Billie and I have played enough shows that they're really fun, but they don't make me nervous anymore. And I carry a less heavy burden every night than she does. People don't come to see a Billie Eilish show to come to see me. They come to see her. So I just try not to screw up too much on my instruments. And
but you produce her music.
I do. I've produced all of her music, yeah.
Does she produce your music?
She would probably deserve an executive production credit. She comes in, tells me when stuff is dope, and she tells me when it's not dope.
And how would you describe the difference between your two sounds?
Well, I think it was always really important to me that if I was going to make music under my own name and still produce all of Billie's music, that they sounded really different from each other. Hmm. Part of the thing that might separate mine is that I grew up playing piano and guitar, and she plays a little bit of piano and guitar, but I definitely like always written sitting at those instruments. And so on pretty much every song of mine, that's like a center point is kind of me sitting at a piano playing music or standing and holding a guitar.
All right, well, let's listen so that our listeners can hear some of your music. This is from your first album, Blood Harmony. This is called Let's Fall in Love for the Night.
You need to pick me up. I'll be there in 25. I like to push my luck. So take my hand, let's take a drive. I've been living in the future. Hoping I might see you sooner. I want you riding shotgun, I knew when I got one right.
So tell us about this song.
So this is a song I wrote while I was in Japan last August. And I was just sitting in hotel rooms. In Japan, it was a really amazing place, but I have never felt more like a beginner in my life. I just didn't know how to do anything in Japan. I didn't know how to get anywhere. I didn't know how to ask for directions. I would like get back to my hotel room at the end of each day and just like give a great sigh of like just resting for a second, because it was just all day like looking every direction trying to figure out my bearings. And I was just writing the song about this like fantasy date that I had never been on. I think that I've been living in the future is that it's like over the date line. So it was literally like the next day.
Uh-huh.
So that's that. I've been living in the future hoping I might see you sooner. It's like, A, it was over the date line, and B, it was just like I fantasize about stuff that hasn't happened all the time.
Would you say that when you hear that, that it's lighter versus a darker sound for Billie Eilish?
Yeah, sure.
And why do you think that is?
Just different songs, I guess. I think, you know, like I try to like articulate whatever that specific sentiment is and then fully realize it. And I guess if you're fully realizing a sentiment of a song like Bury a Friend, it's going to have a darkness to it, right, that a song called Let's Fall in Love for the Night might not, you know, but both sides of the same coin.
Now you both have synesthesia.
Yes.
What is that exactly?
Synesthesia in very simple terms is the semi-random association of colors, shapes, sounds, tastes, smells with random objects, phrases, words.
So how does that play itself out for you?
Well, the whole idea behind synesthesia is that it's essentially innate. So like for me, Let's Fall in Love for the Night is orange. It's like a kind of a rusty orange. It's like an autumn leaf orange. And I don't have any idea why, and I didn't choose it, but it is that way. And people have kind of, in my opinion, like glorified synesthesia into like some superpower, which I don't feel that it's that way, but it's definitely like a fun place to jump off from, you know, if you like, you're like, where do I start with this? And you're like, well, how's it making me feel? You know, and a lot of like what I do as a producer is like sound design and stuff. So like sometimes I'm writing a song and it just, the mood that it's evoking to me is like a rainy day. And I'm like, well, let's try some rain in the background and see how that makes me feel, you know? And it's just like ways to like inspire myself. But yeah, it's definitely like in my case, I mean, there are some people who are like debilitated by their synesthesia. They'll like see the word Lenovo and they'll like taste like wasabi, you know? Like it's really crazy. Synesthesia is intense.
Hmm. Now, when did you first start writing music?
I was 12 when I started writing music.
And you're 22 now.
Yeah. So 10 years.
When people listen to your songs, when I first heard your music, I would never have guessed that you were as young as you are.
Really?
Yeah.
That's awesome. Appreciate it. Thanks, man.
You like that?
Yeah. I think, you know, when I turned 21 or when I turned 20 or even 18, like the joke I would make, I'd be like, yeah, everything I do is just a little less impressive now. And I think...
Still impressive.
I think ultimately when you're young for your category of profession, the thing you really don't want to be is... good for your age. I think you want to just be good. And that's always been my favorite part about Billie, is I think it's so secondary that she happens to be very young. And
she's younger than you are.
She is. She's 17. But continually people are surprised to find out how young she is, which to me is like such a mark of the success of the art, because it's very easy to admire a child prodigy pianist for being so young and so brilliant and so good. But like, I don't know if that's the pianist that you'd want to see concertize in their 30s when there's other incredible 30-year-old pianists.
You know? Well, what has it been like to you to basically live a fully adult life as a 22-year-old?
I really always wanted to be an adult. I didn't really like being an adolescent at all. I'm always not a control freak in that like I boss everybody around, but like a control freak in like I just don't... I like knowing exactly what I get to do that day and having a say. And I think like so much of being a kid, pretty much until you're 10, you just like... do what other people had ideas for you to do, you know? And I hate, like, this is so goofy and it makes me sound like a real piece of work. But I woke up one morning when I was a kid and I was like, the night before I'd been like, I'd love to go to the library tomorrow and pick out a book. And I woke up the next morning and my mom was like, surprise, we're going to Disneyland. And I burst into tears because I was like,
you want control.
I had no say in this. And I had a great time at Disneyland that day. Not to say that I didn't, but I have always had a real desire to really know what's going on and what's coming. And I think as an adult, that's 100% of what I get to do.
Who have you learned from?
I learned a lot from my mom and my dad. I learn a lot every time I watch Billie perform. And I learn a lot from a lot of people that I look up to in songwriting. And one of the first people that Billie and I got close with was the artist Khalid, and he's just a really stupendous vocalist and a real scholar of music. Like, he knows so much about so many artists that you'd never expect Khalid to know about. And that's so cool. I'm a big fan of that.
One part of fame can be that your circle of friends can shift, and you actually talk about that on your album with the song Lost a Friend. Let's listen to a little bit of that.
I lost a friend, I lost a friend, I lost my mind. Nobody believes me, say I know that he don't need me. Cause he made a little too much money to be 20 and sad.
Give me the backstory of this song.
This is a song I wrote at some point last summer. It was, you know, pretty much autobiographical about a friendship of mine that had, you know, lasted all through high school and then kind of fallen apart. And I think it's okay to have friends come and go in your life depending on how much real life value that you add to each other. Like, sometimes you just grow up and you have different interests and you ride in different waves. And I think that's okay. But in this case, we were like still best friends, and I felt that there was a raw patch there of some form of resentment or maybe misguided envy or something. And at the time, I wasn't really sure how to deal with that, but I decided that it was probably best to try to write a song about it and to not write a song that was vilifying that person in any way or trying to make myself look like the victim. I'm really glad I wrote that song because it's been fun to see how many people have connected with it and be like, oh, wow, this is, I guess everybody goes through that, where there's a lot of like breakup songs that you can listen to and mm-hmm. you fall out of love, but there's not a lot of like friendship breakup songs.
Well, the song that I first heard of yours was Angel.
After you fall asleep, I'll kiss both your eyes and cheeks. I know we're not the same.
How do you feel about that one?
That's like a straight ahead like love song about my girlfriend Claudia, who I just am very in love with sort of at all points in time. And I was sitting down at a piano like pretty much like almost a year ago to the day. I was sitting down at a piano in Arizona in a green room, and it was not even early in the morning, but I had just woken up because on tour you sleep very late. Mm-hmm. And I could barely talk. I was like clearing my throat over and over and over to try to sing. And I was just playing that piano part that I thought was
pretty. It just happened like that.
Yeah. Yeah. But that song means a lot to me. And I sent it to Claudia right when I wrote it. And she texted me back a picture of tears in her eyes. And I was like, oh, then it's done.
That is Phineas, whose new album is called Blood Harmony, and he has just wrapped up his first solo tour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it. Thanks for playing the song. That means a lot to me.
The coronavirus has spread to over a dozen countries, with now more than 4,500 reported cases and more than 100 reported deaths. And there are now concerns not only about public health, but also about the economic impact of the virus. Stock markets recovered slightly today after Monday's drop off of more than 450 points in response. For the Dow Jones Industrial Average, it was the biggest single-day drop since last October. For more, we're joined by Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. And Robin, what's the biggest concerns for companies and investors right now?
You have swaths of the planet's second biggest economy. It's a $14 trillion GDP, and it's also the manufacturing headquarters of the global supply chain. I mean, city after city on lockdown increasingly. So outside of the very real fears of human illness spreading, multinationals everywhere, they're just wondering how much of a business hit they're going to be taking, both from a demand for their goods from the Chinese consumers and how they're going to get goods out globally from Asian factories. So it's like HR, capitalism, contagion, healthcare, all rolled into a giant question mark.
Yeah. Yeah. I've read that some analysts are saying that this is a correction following a period of trading at near all-time highs. So I'm just guessing there are multiple factors at work.
Well, whenever you have such a relentless melt up in stocks, 2019 was gangbusters and that finally started spreading to emerging markets, which are very linked to China. You're increasingly pricing in a perfection that you can say is kind of distanced from the reality of things that go wrong. And people on Wall Street call that exogenous shocks, natural disasters, pandemics. They do happen. And this scare, thankfully, it's just a scare so far as a reminder.
Hmm. We're hearing now from Germany and Japan that cases of the coronavirus in people who had not traveled to China but obviously came in contact with someone who had. Of course, we're thinking about the human toll, as you said, about all of this. But what's the biggest threat to the U.S. economy as this virus spreads?
Yeah, to us here, it's no doubt a multiplication of the five or so confirmed cases in the U.S. and then the quarantines and extraordinary transportation and public health measures that would follow. Thankfully, we're not there yet. It's more at this point about multinationals like Apple wondering how this is going to hit iPhone inventories. I mean, I know that sounds mercenary, but that's a more than a $1 trillion company, and so much of that phone, soup to nuts, is manufactured in China.
Yeah. Thinking about stock markets, they're resilient. We saw comebacks after SARS, the bird flu, and Ebola. Is this any different, do you think? I know we're in the midst of it.
SARS was certainly scary when it happened, but you know, there's no institutional memory of Spanish flu 100 years ago, which paralyzed the world, 50 to 100 million people. And we've not seen that kind of example in the modern era, a nightmare scenario, thankfully, in the era of open borders and free trade. How do governments coordinate with the World Health Organization? How, if necessary, do central banks coordinate? Broadly, how do you stop the world from feeding on fear, which would paralyze the whole economy? Again, that's thankfully just in the theoretical right now.
Yeah, and we've been talking about travel industries and airlines. What other industries, with the 30 seconds I have with you, might be feeling the impact of this?
Now, anything professional services. You think about Western bankers and consultants who are almost entirely focused on the Chinese economy. Certain commodities, the farm sector has been breathing a sigh of relief from a trade agreement, commodities, copper, all of that, thankfully, at this point is just so much wrapped up in fear and not actual decline in demand pullback.
That's Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Thank you.
Thank you, Tanya.
Eight days into the Senate impeachment trial, you'd be forgiven if you haven't caught every word on the Senate floor. So we're going to take a moment now to hear some of what happened yesterday as the president's defense team made its case. One of the lawyers representing President Trump was Ken Starr, who began by decrying what he called the age of impeachment, despite the fact that it was Starr who led the impeachment efforts against Bill Clinton 22 years ago as a special prosecutor. Starr's main claim is that the House's second article of impeachment against President Trump, obstruction of Congress, has no legal basis. Instead, he argued, executive privilege means the president can ignore subpoenas from Congress without issue.
This court is very familiar with United States versus Nixon. Its unanimity in recognizing the president's profound interest in confidentiality, regardless of the worldview or philosophy of the justices were unanimous. This isn't just a contrivance. It's built into the very nature of our constitutional order. So let me comment briefly. This constitutionally based recognition of executive privilege, and then companion privileges, the deliberative process privilege, the immunity of close presidential advisors from being summoned to testify. These are all firmly established in our law. If there is a dispute between the People's House and the President of the United States over the availability of documents or witnesses, and there is in each and every administration, then go to court. It really is as simple as that. I don't need to belabor the point. But here's the point I would like to emphasize. Frequently, the Justice Department advises the President of the United States that the protection of the presidency calls whatever the president might want to do as a political matter, as an accommodation and a spirit of comity, to protect privileged conversations and communications. I've heard it in my two tours of duty at the Justice Department. Don't release the documents, Mr. President. If you do, you're injuring the presidency.
Meanwhile, Trump lawyer Jane Raskin gave a very literary defense of the president by focusing on his personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, and claiming that Democrats are using Giuliani as a colorful distraction.
The House managers would have you believe that Mr. Giuliani is at the center of this controversy. They've anointed him the proxy villain of the tale, the leader of a rogue operation. Their presentations were filled with ad hominem attacks and name-calling. Cold-blooded political operative, political bagman. But I suggest to you that he's front and center in their narrative for one reason and one reason alone: to distract from the fact that the evidence does not support their claims. So what's the first tell that Mr. Giuliani's role in this may not be all that it's cracked up to be? They didn't subpoena him to testify. In fact, Mr. Schiff and his committee never even invited him to testify. They took a stab at subpoenaing his documents back in September, And when his lawyer responded with legal defenses to the production, the House walked away. But if Rudy Giuliani is everything they say he is, don't you think they would have subpoenaed and pursued his testimony? Ask yourselves, why didn't they?
The defense returned to that argument many times yesterday, that the House should have opted for a comprehensive trial rather than a swift one. Later in the day, we heard from Trump attorney Pam Bondi, whose history with Trump dates back to when she was the attorney general of Florida and declined to investigate Trump University when it was being accused of fraud. In her remarks, Bondi tried to establish Trump was genuinely worried about corruption at Burisma, the natural gas company where Hunter Biden was employed by the Ukrainian oligarch Mykola Zlochevsky.
George Kent, the very first witness that the Democrats called during their public hearings, testified Zlochevsky stood out for his self-dealings, even among other oligarchs. House managers didn't tell you that. Ambassador Kurt Volker explained that Burisma had a, quote, very bad reputation as a company for corruption and money laundering, end quote. House managers didn't tell you that. Burisma was so corrupt that George Kent said he intervened to prevent USAID from co-sponsoring an event with Burisma. You know what this event was? It was a child's contest, and the prize was a camera. They were so bad, Burisma, that our country wouldn't even co-sponsor a children's event with Burisma.
Later, we heard from Trump lawyer and former Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz, who lectured the Senate on constitutional history. He opened his statements by claiming his own impartiality.
I stand before you today as I stood in 1973 and 1974 for the protection of the constitutional and procedural rights of Richard Nixon, who I personally abhorred, and whose impeachment I personally favored. And as I stood for the rights of Bill Clinton, who I admired, and whose impeachment I strongly opposed, I stand against the application and misapplication of the constitutional criteria in every case and against any president, without regard to whether I support his or her parties or policies. I would be making the very same constitutional argument had Hillary Clinton, for whom I voted, been elected and had a Republican House voted to impeach her on these unconstitutional grounds. I am here today because I love my country and our Constitution. Everyone in this room shares that love.
Dershowitz argued that abuse of power and obstruction of Congress are not impeachable offenses because they are too vague, and the framers tried to protect the presidency from vague language, fearing that otherwise Congress could impeach a president over anything.
Some framers, such as Roger Sherman, wanted the president to be removable by the national legislature at its pleasure, much like the British prime minister can be removed by a simple vote of no confidence by Parliament. That view was rejected. Benjamin Franklin opposed decidedly the making of the executive, quote, the mere creature of the legislature. Gouverneur Morris was against the dependence of the executive on the legislature, considering the legislature, you will pardon me quoting this, a great danger to be apprehended. I don't agree with that. James Madison expressed concerns about the president being improperly dependent on the legislature. Others worried about a feeble executive. Hearing these and other arguments against turning the new republic into a parliamentary democracy in which the legislature had the power to remove the president, the framers set out to strike the appropriate balance between the broad concerns that led them to vote for a provision authorizing the impeachment of the president and the need for specific criteria not subject to legislative abuse or overuse. Among the criteria proposed were malpractice, neglect of duty, malconduct, neglect in the execution of office, and this word we'll come back to talk about, maladministration. It was a response to that last term, a term used in Britain as a criteria for impeachment, that Madison responded, so vague a term will be equivalent to a tenure during the pleasure of the Senate. Upon hearing Madison's objections, Colonel Mason withdrew maladministration and substituted other high crimes and misdemeanors. Had a delegate proposed inclusion of abuse of power or obstruction of Congress as enumerated and defined criteria for impeachment, history strongly suggests that Madison would have similarly opposed it, and it would have been rejected.
Some of the moments from yesterday's testimony by President Trump's legal team. This is only the third time in history that this country has had a presidential impeachment trial in the Senate, and it is the first time there's been one in an election year, this one taking place with just days to go before the Iowa caucuses.
Since the coronavirus outbreak began in China, we've seen people everywhere wearing face masks as a form of protection. There are now shortages in many parts of the world. We wonder just how effective these masks are as protection against airborne viruses, including the flu. To answer that question and the latest on the coronavirus, we have with us Dr. William Schaffner, an infectious disease expert at Vanderbilt University Medical Center. Dr. Schaffner, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Tanya. Good to be with you.
So we're hearing that factories are rushing to boost production of face masks in China. The demand is just so high. Do these masks actually make a difference?
Well, when masks are used by persons in the healthcare environment where they're trained to use them, actually we use kind of super masks called N95 respirators. They're much thicker than the average surgical masks. The data supporting the use of masks by members of the community to prevent infection, those data are pretty scanty. And of course, that's why the CDC doesn't recommend that each influenza season we all go around masked, because we just don't know how good they are. They may provide some protection, but not complete.
So you mentioned in hospital settings, medical officials use these masks, N95 respirators. Do they offer protection more so to prevent sickness or from others getting sick, meaning that it is a two-way street?
Yes, it's a two-way street. It would be inadvisable for you if you are ill, coughing and sneezing and the like, to put on a mask and still go to work. You will not reduce very much your risk to others.
We actually read this study that suggested people touch their faces about 23 times an hour. So I'm thinking about if you don't have a mask that is as protective as medical personnel, these really thick masks, does it help in that maybe it just stops you from touching your face?
It probably does to some degree, but you will touch the outside of the mask. But remember, the touch to your lips mode of transmission is the byway of transmission. The highway is respiratory spread. If two people are in an enclosed environment within 3 feet of each other, you're within the breathing zone. You breathe it in. That's how most transmission of respiratory infections occurs.
So during the wildfires here in California, folks were wearing these masks to protect themselves from the smoke in the air. And those are very different from these surgical masks that we're seeing. Are those effective for people as they're headed out? Is that something that you would recommend folks wear to protect themselves from airborne illnesses?
You were issued more serious masks. We actually call them respirators. And if you wore them correctly, they would provide protection not only against the large particulates in the smoke, but they are more protective against viruses.
So, Doctor, what I'm hearing from you is ultimately these masks may make us feel good about being out in the public and public spaces, but really it is not a great protectant from these airborne illness infections like the flu or coronavirus.
The masks certainly make us feel better. They give us a sense of control, but their actual contribution to protection is modest.
So I want to ask you some more questions, particularly about the coronavirus and also the flu, because we're entering flu season. There's so many unanswered questions about coronavirus. For instance, when are people contagious? How long is the period between when a person gets infected and when they develop symptoms? What do we know?
We're learning a lot as things go on. It is thought at the moment that the so-called incubation period, the period between the time of exposure and the time of illness, can range from about 2 up to 14 days, with an average of about 10 days. That's actually rather long for a respiratory infection.
A much likelier threat this season for us here in the U.S. specifically is the flu. We talk about this every year, but what is your advice for protecting ourselves from the flu? Many folks are actually thinking about these masks as one way, but you're saying that really is not the way.
We don't recommend the use of masks because the data supporting their use in a community setting is, shall we say, scant. Now, the fundamental way to protect ourselves against influenza, of course, is vaccination. It's very late this year because flu is abundant in every state right now. So run, do not walk, and get yourself vaccinated. And then, of course, a lot of good hand hygiene. And should you become ill, call your healthcare provider, and they may provide an antiviral drug which can reduce the severity of your illness.
So it's not too late to get the flu shot if you haven't gotten it already, you're saying?
It's late, but not too late.
Yeah, well, that's good to know. That's infectious disease expert Dr. William Schaffner. Dr. Schaffner, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure, and let's all stay healthy.
Good advice. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Thanks to our friends here at WUNC in Chapel Hill for hosting us. It's Here and Now.
You've got questions about President Donald Trump's impeachment trial, and we've got answers. NPR's senior editor and correspondent Ron Elving will take on some of your questions about the impeachment process and the projected outcome. That's next time on Here and Now.